Well, good day, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. We're here at EMS Today 2016 in Baltimore. This is actually a lunchroom we're sitting in, but this was the best way for me to get together with, and then we got the sound effects courtesy of Jim. So we're going to be talking here about the pretty incredible mass casualty active shooter drill that Paragon put on yesterday as part of the resources they're doing here. They're providing here at the conference. And so before we get to that, I want to bring on my amazing and incredible right-hand person who's actually sitting to my left, Sam Bradley.
Hey there. Yes, we are sitting in very windy, and it's been very rainy Baltimore. We have some interesting weather events going on around the country at the moment. I'm sure we'll be talking more about that later. But it's quite a pleasure to be sitting here actually at the table with the elusive Jim Logan that we know is the Sasquatch, Dr. Joe Holly, Jamie's son Chris is doing the audio for us, and Amanda, one of their Paragon team who we chatted with yesterday. This was a neat experience for me because I actually got to partake of some of the education. Thank you for the free lecture. I enjoyed that. Learned a lot from that. And looking at the very large, Joe, how many people do you think you had there altogether?
I think we were between 60 and 70. It filled up, sold out a couple of months back, and actually sort of ended up bringing in a few more folks than we had originally intended. So had to be a very well-attended event.
Yeah, there was a very large group of people. It seemed like a good mix of law enforcement, fire, medics. You said there was a number of EMTs in there as well.
Yeah, I think we probably had 20 or 30% basic responders that were there. We had tremendous assistance and turnout from Baltimore Police Department, who were excellent and attended and had a great time, I think, during the day. So really went well.
I really enjoyed your lecturer that did a lot of the more police-oriented stuff, and then of course you did more of the clinical things. What's his background?
He was that's Perry McEwen. He's with the sheriff's office in Shelby County, where we are based, and has been working with, been in law enforcement for many years, more years than I can remember. And has a background in bomb squad and tactical and you name it. So Perry's very well versed in that side of the house for us.
Yeah, I was very impressed with him during the actual exercise and, as he ran around loading and shooting very loud guns.
He likes to do that.
Yes, I could see that. So, Jim, what was your role? I saw you kind of running around, trying to keep this event all moving in the right direction, because you guys were spread out all over the place.
Well, that was my role, to run around, I guess. So, and to help
put
Amanda.
Tape on the doors. And
yeah, so Amanda's with us. So Amanda was our lead facilitator for this event, for the active shooter, the emerging threat event. And so I was just kind of helping with logistics and setup of the simulation piece of it. Of course, the course is broken up into about three phases. One is about an hour and a half lecture that you saw Joe and Perry do. And then we break out into some breakout sessions and learn about the different facets of the best practices of active shooter, what's going on across the nation, what's being endorsed by FEMA and law enforcement, fire, and EMS as best practices and policy. And when we put all that together, at the end of the day, we have a scenario which we include a live tissue.
Amanda, why don't you explain a little bit about what some of those static stations are, because they're pretty fascinating, what everybody rotates through.
So we've got, during the breakout sections, we actually have six different sessions. We have three cadaveric, and then we have three that are more along the lines of things like ICS. We have a sift and sort station where we introduce a new concept of going in and not doing a traditional triage, but actually seeing who can we save and who can we not. And so it's a really different thought process there, because we're used to getting them out and taking care of them and tagging them. And so there's a different thought process there. And then we also introduce a law enforcement piece in that part, where we as EMS providers just go in and kind of see, what are they doing? We always ask ourselves, what are those cops doing, or vice versa? And so it puts each other in those different places and those different shoes. And then on the cadaveric side, we have gross anatomy, we have advanced airway, and then we have a hemorrhage control section as well, and the students get to go through each of those.
Yeah, a lot of people were commenting on the gross anatomy, and, you know, that sounds so basic, but one of the EMTs I talked to said, you know, there was a bullet wound in there where you see where it goes in, and it doesn't look like much, but when you see what it does on the inside, that's pretty mind-blowing, and that's something that most EMTs and many medics never get the opportunity to really see.
Yeah, that's a unique feature that that we bring to the table in this experience is, thank goodness, most of the providers don't see a whole lot of gunshot wounds unless they live in a high-volume system, live and work, right, in a high-volume system. And so this kind of brings it home. You know, you can look at two-dimensional all day long, but, you know, we get to go ahead and dissect down to where the bullet, the trajectory, and what organs it affected. And so we look at basically medium and high velocity rounds, what the differences are.
Well, in general, even with your other cadaver labs, that's one thing I've heard consistently is just working with human tissue is such a better experience, regardless of what tools you're using, if you're using something new that they've never had an opportunity, because you try to get vendors in there with new tools and let them practice on it. So it's good for the vendor, for people to feedback from that experience, but it gives them the chance to do something entirely new. And I remember one fellow from last year, I think I told you, where he was a new medic and just could not intubate. He was having the worst trouble trying to intubate. And then he came to your lab and he dropped a tube and he said, I've never missed one since. So I don't know what happened there, but it worked.
Well, that's the beauty of the labs like that, because if you're going to make a mistake, that's where you want to make it. And so that's where you can learn from it without doing any damage to our patients. And so it's not only that kind of experience, and it's an experience of getting your hands on all kind of tools of the trade that maybe you've seen and you'd love to use, but you don't get to, and then maybe you get to take it back to your hometown and say, hey, look, we've really got to look at this and see what we can do to incorporate this in. The other beautiful thing of the cadaver labs is the fact that all levels get to do whatever. And so, you know, these guys who are EMTs and first responders may never actually intubate a patient, but now they understand why that medic's standing upside down on their head trying to get that tube in, and the challenges that goes with that. So it helps to bring just that overall team effect when you go back home and work with somebody else.
Joe, one of the core messages that I heard, I talked to a couple folks from New York, and you know, he kind of encapsulated it, a deputy chief that was there, and he said, and to come from New York, I was most interested in it. He said, we got to get out of our silos. We got to train together. This is a new world. When it hits the fan, we're all in it together, and it's dangerous for responders if they don't know, like you said, you know, cops don't know what the medics are doing, medics don't know what the cops are doing. Cops need to protect the medics. And another thing, just as I'm thinking about it, you use the rescue task force concept with this exercise, which I was pleased to see. That's a method of training that we used in the department I work for. But can you speak to that?
Sure. So I think in regards to the first subject, you know, the one of the bitter lessons out of World Trade Center and Pentagon stuff was interoperability. And a lot of efforts put toward, you know, radio systems that talk to each other, et cetera. I don't know that we've yet managed to get interoperability amongst people. And the real challenge of getting us out of our silos and getting us talking to each other. And it was really fascinating yesterday to go from what seemed sort of mass chaos and lots of false starts and misdirection and all that sort of stuff to an operation that actually went pretty smoothly, and it only took, you know, two or three iterations and a couple hours. And so it's not that it's hard stuff, it's just that we don't ever do it. And I think the people do not appreciate how important those individual elements are, things like ICS and all that sort of stuff, until you get into a situation like that and realize I didn't do that first and I should have done that. I don't have anybody to call and ask for that now because I didn't fill that position, or that person wasn't here. I don't even know what we're supposed to be doing. So I think that interoperability piece amongst the people themselves is the absolute key to make these things work. We have to practice these events beforehand, because as you've heard before, that's where we make our mistakes, and that's where our opportunity comes to get those little things corrected and to understand why those elements are all important.
Yeah, I hear when people walk away, they have a whole different mindset about that. If they went into it not so sure, they come out with a different attitude. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, so what was an interesting thing to see yesterday was the engagement of the law officers that were drawn towards the medical side of the house, you know, what we do, the interest that was seen there. And in comparison, the interest of EMS when we did our breakout session to the law enforcement, because they went through what that rescue task force looked like from the law enforcement side, what maneuvers were going to be done, what sweeps were going to be done, and they actually went through those motions. So we feel that by doing that, we offer them some level of understanding about what each other does so we can work as a what? Team.
Hello. Yeah. Well, Jim, explain what the rescue force task force concept is. And, you know, because there's a lot of different levels of tactical training, from the full-on, you know, medic tactical 40-hour or a week-long course to something as simple but effective as rescue task force.
So rescue task force, basically it's EMS and law enforcement working in, if you will, the warm zone of a hazmat in comparison, right? So it's not totally safe, but you've got some protection. So initial entry is made by law enforcement and they go towards the perpetrator. A second team of law enforcement go through and sweep. Then the rescue task force is inserted into the program through ICS, into the rotation. And that can be 2 to 4 law officers, right? One front, one rear, or a diamond formation of law enforcement with 2 to 3 medics in the middle. The medics only move and work together with law enforcement. They only move when law enforcement says it's clear to move. And so they work in the perimeter of that diamond formation, take care of patients. They communicate back and forth. They move as a unit together.
And also the officers, after the threat is mitigated, are free to help them move people.
That's correct.
So you have more sets of hands to help you get people
out. So the objective is to not wait, because the whole concept that we've been working from for years has been EMS and fire is not going in until a building is cleared.
Well, never go out of the cold
some
zone.
Buildings are very large and people die because we wait.
Exactly. Including police officers.
Yes. Yeah.
Amanda, you look like you have some thoughts on that.
It's just, my thought is basically coming back to what Jim said. It's about a team effort. And if I don't know what you're doing and you don't know what I'm doing, then we tend to sometimes fight against each other. And we don't necessarily mean to. It's just we don't have a clue. And so by bringing everybody in together, and I walk in their shoes, they walk in my shoes, and just that better understanding, we're going to deliver better patient care and take care of our victims faster in a more professional way and get them to where they need to be and save lives.
Well, and you're also developing a better relationship.
Oh,
instead
agree,
of,
totally.
Boy, that's that cop with attitude, but you've never had a conversation with him because you've never been able to talk to him outside of a high-stress MVA or something. Well, maybe you get to know this guy a little bit, and relationships can get formed, and there's more interest in training together, I think. So there's some side benefits to that, too.
I agree 100%. I know that we've seen that in previous classes as well.
I think the public expects us to work together and to do this. And quite honestly, it's a breach of the public trust for us not to be truly interoperable and functioning as one single unit on situations like this. It's certainly tragic enough as it is already, but the idea that we're going to make a response to something like that and not be able to maximally do what we have the capability to do is tragic as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, you know, you talk about the cop with the attitude or the EMT with the attitude or whoever. I mean, it goes both ways. But in my experience, and maybe you can talk to this, Jim, is my experience has been that often it's because they were trained to come at a problem that way. And so what we perceive as attitude is really a function of their training, that they have to have a certain carriage, a certain demeanor to do their job, where they have command voice, where they have all these things that they have been taught to do to try to control a situation instantly. And paramedics come at it in their own way to control a situation, but we don't necessarily come at it from the same direction. So what we perceive as this cocky attitude is really how they've been trained.
So the command presence and the command voice, all that was seen yesterday. So when we start these scenarios, all that naturally just comes out because it, your heart rate, even though it's simulated, your heart, there's gunfire, there's screaming and yelling, and there's patience, and there's these human cadavers on the ground that we're working on. And so your heart rate goes up to about 120, 130, and people, you know, kind of get emotional. But we saw that yesterday in the scenario.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like, and maybe this is just an offshoot of the world we live in, but to see that kind of mutual respect and understanding developing between people with very disparate roles, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and
nice.
If this is setting the stage for the future, I think, you know, you use the word interoperability, Joe, and I happen to love that word. It's just not a matter of being forced together and having to function together. It's a matter of really learning about each other and having a level of mutual respect such that you can continue that. So it'll be interesting to see what it's like 10 years from now.
It will indeed. And I think one of the things that we really hope is that folks will leave there, obviously, learning how to better work together to respond to an active shooter. But I hope they equally come out of there with a sense of there's a better way to do things than what we've been doing. And we got a little glimpse of it enough to encourage them to go home and say, wow, that stuff really does make a difference. It really does work to do that. We have got to get going. We've got to engage.
Yeah, I saw that and I totally agree. And I hope those people can convince the powers that be that this is really something they need to look at. Jim?
I was just going to say, I was thinking back on the scenario yesterday afternoon, and some of the comments in the evaluations were, you know, it seemed somewhat disorganized. Well, if you've ever been to a mass casualty, they're not a really organized structure. And to that point, what is the organized structure of that MCI is incident command, right? And so coming from Firebase to EMS, you know, we lived it and breathed it and ate it every call, every day, every minute. Some of these students coming from different backgrounds and different EMS systems, ICS was a class I took. We really don't do it much, you know, that kind of thing. So I feel that's why we got some of those comments. But you could tell yesterday, it looks like chaos, but it's organized chaos. And so that, I think that's an important take home.
Well, and that's what we bring, and that's what we're trained to bring to the situation, even if it's a single patient. We're trained to bring some level of control to an out-of-control situation. We're called to people's emergencies. So applying, I've always heard from somebody a long time ago who said, you know, apply the things you know about handling a single patient, extrapolate it out and apply it to the larger situations, and say, I've got to gain control of this situation and apply some level of control. It may be out of control, but it's my job to bring some semblance of control to whatever's going on. And incident command does that.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people are very used to is managing an incident by themselves with a few other people and getting the job done. So people yesterday were assigned to either the rescue task force or to law or to transfer, whatever section they were in. They didn't see what all was going on, and they thought they had to be part of everything. And with this kind of event of this magnitude, you can't be part of everything. You got to be a piece of the puzzle in ICS.
Yeah. Joe, what are you thinking about moving forward? I mean, Sam mentioned 10 years from now, hopefully we're all doing this. But, you know, that's an incremental step that needs to happen. A lot of incremental steps need to happen in between now and 10 years from now when everybody's playing nice together. You know, it's a nice thing to think about. But what are some of the next steps that somebody listening to this episode or maybe has attended one of your events in the past and wants to know what do they need to do next to start moving their system in the right direction?
Well, I think a lot of that is just taking a bit more of the 10,000-foot view to some of those things and appreciating that there are many, many, many moving and confluent parts to an event like that. And there's an awful lot of things that have to happen. And the more each of the individuals in the event understands something about all of those different functions and has a situational awareness that is beyond what's right in front of them, the better those events run. And the more everybody works together very naturally to reach the appropriate outcome. And I think the more you appreciate the need for structure, ICS, or whatever you want to call it, behind something like that to make those different elements work together and to give them a way to talk to each other and to send information to each other, et cetera. So to me, that's kind of the first step, is to broaden our scope of situational awareness around those events to quite a bit larger than just sort of what I think my role is, because I think you'll find out that the small individual role of the medic or the law enforcement officer or whatever has ripple effects through so many other things. And if you can get to a point where you can be thinking two or three steps ahead of not only what you're currently doing, but what other things you know are going to need to be happening, then the better we manage those events. The classic example is, where did you park your car in front of this event, right? Because you just blocked all ingress and egress for the next thing coming in here. Could we maybe park the car somewhere else? It's just that simple. That tiny decision has a huge impact on the 20 vehicles that are coming behind you that need to get in and out of here, yet I was the first guy here, I just stopped, right? I was in a hurry. Well, okay, but your 2 seconds saved here have caused us 30 minutes of delay back here. So that ripple effect has magnified itself many times over, and it's a million incredibly simple and mundane little details like that that ripple through the response to those issues and ultimately lead to chaos and delays and frustrations, et cetera.
Yeah, so I want to give a shameless plug out to, I think it's education, right?
Exactly.
And it's courses like this. It's whatever level you want to get into it at. We talked about the tactical piece of it. That's one element. What we're talking about, what we're doing in Paragon Experiences with active shooters, is not the tactical medic. It's the first responder. And that's, these events are over in an average of 12 to 15 minutes. And it takes, it takes a good 30 minutes to an hour to get your TAC team or your SWAT team together. So those for barricades and things like that, they have their place. What I'll challenge the listeners to, both nationally and internationally, is to take some EMS courses at the National Fire Academy.
Good point.
Even though, it says the National Fire Academy, it has a whole host of EMS courses. One of them is Emergency Medical Services Function and Incident Command and Incident Operations. Those are the two classes. You do not have to be fire-based. You can come in hospital-based, whatever model of service that you deliver, they welcome you. Not just here, you can apply. I know we got some international listeners as well. You can apply each quarter to these classes, and they are free. They pay for your travel, they pay for your backfill, they pay for your lodging, and I believe they pay, I think that's it. I think you have to pay for your meals. It's like $135. Don't quote me on that, but I think it's $100 and some change for a 6-day course, and food's pretty decent.
Yeah.
So, but it's great education. It's great education.
Well, and I'm thinking, because of the first evolution yesterday, and go back to what you were saying earlier, Jim, that it was chaos. Well, show me a multiple casualty incident that isn't, regardless of what, and to the observer, it's going to seem that way. But like you said, when people are using ICS and you have different people in different roles, you got staging, you got transportation, you got transport, you got all of these different, everybody's doing their thing, but to watch it from a 10,000 foot view, right, it looks like a bunch of ants running around. But take those people that started yesterday, and it was chaotic, but they learned something. So when we did the second evolution, you saw a lot more cohesiveness. Now, take those people, if they had that particular group had the opportunity to do that a few more times or train together, what would that next MCI be like? They would have it down. They would really have a good feel for how to work with each other, and that's it. You train as you play, or you play as you train. However
both.
That works, but
both.
That's the whole
you
idea.
Yeah.
Systems are doing that, and they're training together all the time. You're not only developing that relationship, but you're going to know what you're doing, and you're going to have an element of trust there, which is only developed through relationships.
Yeah. you can have a script to a play, but if you don't practice it and you don't educate yourself on how your lines are supposed to be delivered, it'll fall apart.
Good analogy, yeah. What do you think, Joe? We stymied the port.
That's all right. You know, we're winding down here, and so I just think that it's important to. We're all kind of laughing because, you know, Joe's rarely speechless. But it comes down to training. We keep hearing that over and over again, whether it's education at the National Fire Academy, when your EMS program's there, and I have nothing but good things to say about them. They are just a tremendous resource that is one of the most underutilized things in EMS that just people should know more about it and be active participants in it. But it is training and education, and I think that it's, you know, kudos to Paragon to continue to push the envelope, to continue to push what's going on out there and saying we need to do more, we need to be better at educating people, we need to be better at having that positive impact so that when they leave that class, they're not looking. My goal as an educator has always been to have them leave my class still thinking about my class, not thinking about the next class. And I get the sense from talking to people that have been to your programs, from what I know about the type of education you do, that that's exactly what you do. You have people leaving your class sometimes with more questions than they walked in the door with. And that's a good thing. So my question is, where can people find out more about where they can get Paragon to come in and do something for them? Because that's really where they're going to come in and find the best opportunity to start thinking about this if they haven't already done this in their system.
I will try. I did take my aspirin and gave myself a dose of TPA for my current stroke that I'm having. So I'm better now. Thank you. I agree completely with what you had to say, Jamie. We think that way as well. And we hope that folks will reach out to us to engage us to help them maybe take those first steps and make some progress on that. So they can certainly find us on the web at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. We'll have a brand new website within the next week or so, we hope. They can find us on our Twitter feed at ParagonMedEDU or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Education Group as well. And we're obviously on the Disaster Podcast.
Yeah, and we really appreciate your continued support of the Disaster Podcast. You know, folks, I want you to realize that they're not just, you know, our sponsors, but they're really good friends. They're really fantastic educators. And, you know, we just stand behind what they do 110, 120% because it is.
We want 125.
We want 125. Well, next time. it is the type of education that I wish everybody did. And until you've experienced it for yourself, you're not going to understand what we're talking about. So reach out to them. Talk to them. They're a great group of people, but Joe and Jim and Amanda and the rest of their entire team, just an amazing group of folks. So reach out to them at their website or get a hold of them through the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And, you know, I'd like to add, too, I hope that every one of these people in every one of your events goes away much more educated and maybe encourages somebody else. And maybe that's the one person that's going to save a life that may not have had the skills or the wherewithal to do it before. So, you know, think about it that way. You guys are doing a lot of good when you think of all the people you've already trained. But you'll see me on the disasterpodcast.com. Please come over. If you have questions on this subject, you want to post to any of our guests or just about anything at all, we'd love to hear from you. So and let us know what else you want us to talk about. If it relates to disaster, we'll throw it in there. We found over, you know, we it's interesting because we're in our second year and I'm thinking, well, when are we going to run out of topics? And we never do. Just sitting there talking with a bunch of medics last night, it's like, wow, that'd be a good idea. We've never talked about that. So disaster is what you make it. But one thing for sure, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.